with a bigger voice for our community. So Jorge Mendez is on our NAMI board, and he is a family member, and he also happens to be the director of the psychiatric health facility, the Crisis Care Center. So we're honored to have him be a board member, and I asked him if he would come and explain everything about the statistics of what we're seeing, how many people are hospitalized, how many waiting for beds, how many people are transferred out of the county, why we can't have more services in our own county, why do people go to Angwin. He knows a lot of stuff, and his team does too. But he's an amazing gentleman. I have never called him for help and not had him respond like that at any time of day or night to a client or a family member in distress. So I really appreciate you very much and that you're coming to speak today. So he's been the director at the Behavioral Health Center for just since it opened, 2013. And before that, he was at Front Street. So at Front Street, he was a vice president there, and he learned a lot about one-on-one care and all of the things that people with mental health issues need. And very, very problem-solving oriented person. Our next speaker, or one of his other speakers on his team, is Arveen Santu, kind of new to me. Welcome. He's been at the crisis stabilization side of the building since July of 2015, and I saw something about some background in Peru. Is that right?
Panama.
So it's nice to have you here, and some experience working with dual diagnosed clients, which we do have a lot of people with that need your experience. And Laura Nadel is the clinical director now at the PUF, and somebody I've known for a number of years as a person with an amazing flexibility, sense of humor, love for her clients. She's one of those mental health workers that travels all over the state to visit her clients wherever they're housed, and they can't wait to see her. Another problem-solving person with a big heart. It's very hard work. We appreciate the hard work that you all do for our family members. So with that, let's please welcome our presenter.
Hi, everyone. So again, I'm Jorge Mendez, and I'm the administrator of the Behavioral Health Center, which is comprised of a crisis stabilization program and also an inpatient psychiatric health facility. Just for background, to make sure that everyone is aware of one of the changes that happened in our community was a couple of years ago, Dominican closed. Dominican was previously running the inpatient psych facility. And in negotiation with the county, we opened up the psychiatric health center, the behavioral health center, which really started off with three different parts. I mentioned the crisis stabilization side, the psychiatric health facility side, which is the inpatient. And then separately, there's also a crisis intervention service for youth. That crisis intervention service has now been merged with the crisis stabilization program. So we effectively right now have two different parts of the behavioral health center. The CSP, which serves both youth and adults. And then we have the inpatient side, the psychiatric health facility for 16, with a capacity of 16. So that's what we're going to focus on today, is really talking about what has happened in the last couple of years that we've been open since December of 2013. Any questions around that background? So brief descriptions about what we have. The Crisis Stabilization Program is described as an outpatient emergency service for adults and youth experiencing a crisis related to a mental health condition. Services include assessment, urgent mental health care, and referral to mental health and or co-occurring substance abuse treatment services. On the inpatient side, we serve those same individuals, and there they receive intensive mental health and psychiatric treatment services. I'm going to start off with, just some brief stats on the last calendar year, which began January 2015 and just ended December 2015. So I mentioned that these two merged. So in that 12-month period, we saw 250 minors. We conducted 250 assessments and 1830 assessments on adults. So combined, it's around 2,080 assessments that were conducted on the crisis stabilization side. Out of those 2,000 assessments, we really only served 1,400 patients. So 1,400 patients had a total of over 2,000 admissions to the crisis stabilization program. From the crisis stabilization program, we then move into the PUF, which served a total of 388 patients with a total number of 504 episodes, or 504 admissions to the psychiatric health facility. So really what you're seeing is the number of episodes on top of the number of people that we serve. And we'll go a little bit deeper into that. Any questions?
Would you say that last sentence again? You said 504 episodes.
Mm-hmm. So basically,
patients.
No, it's confusing for that reason. Unduplicated patients, there were 388.
Okay.
So let's say on the CSP, one patient had the highest number of admissions, which was 13. Yeah. So in a 12-month period, he came into the CSP 13 times. So even though we had 2,000 admissions, one of those patients accounted for 13 of them. So mm-hmm. that's why you see a much higher number of episodes compared to the number of patients actually served.
Okay.
So these are individuals, and these are visits to the hospital.
Okay. Thank you.
It's scarier when you've been staring at this for a couple of weeks and you're trying to make sense of it to make sure that you understand it firmly. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the CSP itself. Again, these are some of the stats just to guys give you background on volume that's coming into the CSP. And next, Arvina is going to talk about the CSP.
Hello again. I'm Arvina Sandhu. I'm the program director for the Crisis Stabilization Program. So that is technically the outpatient side of the psychiatric health facility. So the CSP is a 23-hour program. So on that side, we have the difficult job of within 23 hours assessing clients and making the decision as to if they're safe to return back to the community or if they're going to need further treatment. Adults can present there voluntarily or on a 5150. We also get conserved clients. We work with about 7 different jurisdictions as far as law enforcement goes. So Santa Cruz, Sheriffs and Police, Capitola, Scotts Valley, Watsonville, UCSC. We've had clients from Highway Patrol, and we also get clients from Dominican Emergency Room and Watsonville Emergency Room. And then separately, the voluntary clients that walk in, and they can be from different states sometimes or just all over. We do also take youth patients, so we're designed to house one minor at a time. However, if another minor is brought to us via law enforcement, we take them as well. So I think we've had maybe 3 or 4 at once was the highest number of youth clients that we've had. And like Jorge mentioned, the crisis intervention services for the minors just recently merged with the CSP. That's a recent change. As he mentioned before, we conducted over 2,000 assessments, so about 2,080 or around there annually on the CSP since it opened. 38% of those adults do go inpatient, meaning they need further treatment. The state average is about 33%. And then 48% of the minors also need an inpatient. The average length of stay is 12 hours on the crisis unit. Other than that, the licensed mental health professionals that we have include the registered nurses, the psychiatric social workers, licensed vocational nurses, and the nurse practitioners, so psychiatric nurse practitioners. We do function like an emergency room, so it's just like the emergency room without the medical portion. We're 24 hours a day. We conduct assessments on every single shift. We reassess clients on every single shift. We discharge at all hours of the day, and it's just a nonstop service. The recovery culture increased patient and staff safety. So this is one of the main focuses on the crisis unit. I believe in the year we had about 120 seclusion restraints combined. That number is equivalent to the number of seclusion and restraints that Dominican had in a month. So we had that over the span of a year.
So that's, I'd like to applaud that.
Yes.
What is recovery culture?
So to us, what that means is, you know, we want to focus more on each individual and not just, you know, they're not their diagnoses. Just finding what they do want, you know, what plans they have for themselves and what other things their life consists of, and instead of just that diagnosis. So really focusing on trying to find that and help them with that and relate to them in that way. Also just, I mean, you know, with the recovery, just giving them that power, the seclusions, the restraints, even intramuscular injections, that's an absolute last resort, but reminding them that they have control and helping them with their coping strategies. And, you know, if they're an artist, letting them draw. If they like to sing, letting them do that. Really trying to focus on stuff like that. Yes?
Maybe I should have asked Jorge this, but it just came to me now. Mm-hmm. What was the reason for combining the youth with the adults in the CSP?
Yeah, and I think that needs a little bit of clarification. So really the service itself, the crisis stabilization service, is what's been merged. Physically, they are still two distinct areas of the building. So minors will still be housed separately from the adults. They're just all part of the A crisis stabilization service, but they're still partitioned. They're doors between the two areas.
Okay, that was a concern.
I don't see on the list of workers a psychiatrist or a physician.
Right. On the crisis unit, we do not have a psychiatrist. On site, we always do have one available. So we actually have a couple of psychiatrists that are always available to consult with.
And so therefore, the other health professionals, have they been trained specifically in mental health?
Correct.
Issues?
They all have mental health experience.
Okay.
Yes.
So you have access to people's histories, I assume, who've come from the county system.
Correct.
And can help get them back on medication and work.
Correct.
On stabilization.
I'm going to go over the assessments and I'll go into that as well. But yes, we do. Yes.
How are people referred to the program?
It can be a number of ways. So either if a family member convinces their loved one to come in, maybe it took them about a week to convince them if they're willing to come in voluntarily. It can be if a family member called law enforcement to conduct a welfare check on their loved one. It can be if a case manager or coordinator noticed that a client isn't doing well and went out and assessed them, and that can turn out either way. They may have to involve law enforcement or other mental health professionals to get them to our facility, or they convince them to come in voluntarily. Yes.
So when clients come in, what is the average time that they have to wait to be assessed for adults and for youth?
That really depends. So when we go over the assessments, I can explain the process that we follow for everyone in the workflow.
Is the intake, is that the same for elderly and youth? Or do they need to be referred in a different way?
No, it's, the youth we don't take voluntarily. So we only get youth on the 5585 holds. So they either come directly from law enforcement or we get them from the hospitals.
So if your youth wants to go and get assessed, they need to go to Dominican?
Correct, or law enforcement can be called to do the welfare check as well and conduct that evaluation. Yeah.
There was an article in the Mercury a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if anybody read it, about what Santa Clara County is doing, and it kind of exposed the problem with youth. It's kind of like, you know, the first person there gets the bed, and then after that, the next child, anybody under 17, has to be shipped out. Is that pretty much the situation here?
No, so because we are an outpatient service, if somebody requires inpatient treatment, they all have to be shipped out. Unfortunately, we don't have any resources here. They all go over the hill for that inpatient treatment.
And it sounds like they have the same situation there.
Correct.
But in the article, you know, kids are going anywhere from San Francisco to Bakersfield.
That's definitely a gap in the system.
Yeah, we preferred kids as far down to San Diego.
Because there's no money for inpatient beds.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, I think it's just the state of the state. I know that we've searched as far down as San Diego, and in some cases, you know, these are minors that stay with us for multiple days in, you know, quite frankly, not the best environment for that, because it wasn't built to really hold someone for multiple days. It really is just designed to be an evaluation and assessment area. And, you know, sometimes the good thing about keeping them there multiple days is that they clear up, situations change, and we're able to then release back home with different plans. You know, and again, people do change after multiple days.
Do you know if the new rule from the H.R. 4626 or whatever it is, the House bill, would that give us beds in our county?
I don't know of any active plans by the county to find beds here, but I wouldn't be able to answer that definitively, though. I know that Fremont just last December, right, December 2014, expanded its number of beds for adolescents and minors, so that relieved a lot of the pressure that we were feeling. But of course, I mean, it's not just us, it's other Bay Area cities as well that are having to locate psych beds for kids. You know, one of the, you know, big promises, I know Carol was looking forward to having someone from the county here to kind of speak on some of these issues as well, because, you know, we overlap, I think, in what we're responsible for. One of the good things about the county and one of the efforts that they've been launching is the mobile crisis team to really go out and assess minors in their home and not necessarily have to bring them into the crisis stabilization program. It's been a soft rollout of the mobile crisis team, but I know that they've been very diligent and they've been very helpful. I know to Dominican, they have a psychologist there that now is able to assess minors there in the hospital, so they no longer have to make a stopover on the CSP if they need hospitalization or to be released. So I know that for us, that's been one of the more immediate changes, that Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, there is a psychologist, which is way more than we had. And again, I mean, when you have minors waiting at Dominican, also for multiple days, because we've got a minor on our unit that's helpful, that that the community definitely needs. There's also a big focus now by one of the county managers also to make sure that, you know, we're really minimizing the number of hospitalizations for minors and really making those only the ones that are necessary, because we are having to send them out so far away. So, you know, we're working with the county to collaborate on some of these efforts.
Thank you. Why are there no beds for people who need hospitalization?
As far as minors or adults?
Adults,
it's just one of the areas.
Because
that
Governor Reagan emptied the mental hospitals.
It goes back to that all the way.
In Dominican, there were, I don't know how many beds, but they were right there. We could go there every day and see our loved ones.
Absolutely, yeah. I think Dominican went through some of its own changes, but I think when it closed in 2015, I think even then they had 18 beds versus 16 that we have now.
Yeah. Is it because of the expense?
They had 24 at some point, but then I think it was reduced to 18 before they closed.
Is it because of the expense?
Let me, I'll throw out this stat for us. You know, again, our capacity is 16. We are pretty typically at over 14 patients per day. So if you were to take our average, we only serve 14 patients, which means that we're not always full. In mental health, one of the unfortunate things is that it ebbs and flows. So you have these periods when you're just bulging at the seams, you're trying to process everyone as quickly as possible, trying to get them to the care that they need. Coincidentally, the same thing is happening out in the Bay Area because it's related to the moon, it's related to so many other factors. So simultaneously, it seems like regionally, we all begin to experience this strain where we have to find beds someplace else. When there are other days, like a couple of weeks ago, when we had an average census of 7 for the week, 7 or 8. So we were only half full. So I think that really contributes really to why we're not always able to hospitalize people on the psychiatric health facility.
Where are you located? Nowhere to be found.
Okay. I can give you the address. It's 2250 Soquel Avenue.
So same as the psychiatric health facility.
That's what we are, yes. So the crisis
so
is the
are
campus.
Are you the BHU or the psychiatric health facility?
So we are the psychiatric health facility, but the campus is comprised of the crisis unit and then right next door the inpatient psychiatric health facility. So it is all one building.
Okay, and I assume you would have a different
Let's see, which one is there? Yeah, so 2800 is for the crisis unit, and then the 2801 is for the inpatient side.
Yeah, I think the building's official name is the Santa Cruz Behavioral Health Center. I know that a lot of times initially we were using the acronyms, the CSP, the PUF, but that was really just confusing everybody. No one knew how to get patients into the hospital. So we kind of just tried to consolidate and refer to ourselves as the Behavioral Health Center. The CSP is the front door to most of the patients that come in. So if they're being brought in by law enforcement involuntarily from Dominican by ambulance, or if they are walk-ins, they're walking into the CSP. So let's say out of those 2,000 patients that the CSP sees a year, 38% of them end up on the psychiatric health facility, on the inpatient side. So the CSP hospitalizes about a third of the patients that they assess.
I'm confused.
I'm totally
confused. Yeah. Because you said all hospitalizations are shipped out. Yeah, you have a...
Sorry, no, that was for minors.
Oh, for minors.
Yes. The definition?
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
There.
Yeah.
Right there.
See that?
I'm sure you've gone over this issue to oblivion, but I can't see where behavioral health explains what it is, what the problem is.
Oh, the name.
Yeah, it's so politically roundabout, oblivious to me. I can't get it. I've never been able to get it because I know the Dominican they had the mental health building, and then suddenly it became the BHU. What the heck is that?
I think one of those might be just an attempt to really kind of merge aspects of mental health with also the co-occurring substance use disorder. So kind of capture just under an umbrella behavioral health care versus strictly mental health, because there are other factors that affect it. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Why is there no psychiatrist on staff?
On the CSP? On the CSP, you know, the clinicians that are there are the registered nurses and the social workers. And any cases that are too complex for them to assess get seen by a psychiatrist on the inpatient side.
Okay.
So before, during the first 6 months of operation, we had psychiatrists working on the CSP. Their hospitalization rates were closer to 30% throughout that time, so very low hospitalization rates. They went up slightly with the with changes in staffing that we had when we removed the psychiatrist. And I think what was happening was our clinicians were being more cautious and hospitalizing individuals with a higher frequency. Not significant, but definitely hospitalizing at a higher rate, which, again, is not necessarily a bad thing when, you know, we kind of live in the environment that we live in, and we all want to prevent, you know, some of the tragedies that, you know, happen. So.
That kind of seems, well, what is the exact training then of who's doing the evaluating? It, from what you said, it sounds like that is a semi-subjective decision rather than an objective criteria.
You know, and I think most clinicians would say that there's a bit of art, I think, to the clinical work that they do. And, you know, we definitely don't like to leave it up to art to make such critical decisions. Mm-hmm. So we do have risk assessment tools that we use and assessment tools that are pretty that are standardized for all of our staff to use. In terms of the training and qualifications of the staff, these are mental health professionals. So the psychiatric social workers do go to school to conduct assessments, and after they get hired, they're assessed and monitored to make sure that their assessments are coinciding with good standards of care, and that's definitely where the managers come in, the clinical director, to review those. I wanted to mention that also at the beginning. I forgot. I did put some handouts out in the front that, you know, feel free to, you know, jot down any questions that you guys might have about it. A couple of documents. One is the crisis stabilization. These are documents that were created by Telecare and by the county before opening, and we revised it about 6 months ago. It basically lists out the criteria that has to be met for patients to be served on the crisis stabilization side. For example, if you're over the age of 64, we require a medical screening, which requires the patient go to Dominican to be evaluated by medical doctors before they're assessed on the crisis stabilization side. So this lists out some of the requirements and also lists out the exclusionary criteria, things that would not be allowed on the CSP. So, for example, if someone does have a psychiatric crisis but they require an IV, they're not able to come to the CSP. They have to stay in place, stay at Dominican perhaps until that medical issue is resolved, and then we would be able to assess. Same thing on the psychiatric health facility side. This has kind of the same criteria and exclusionary criteria. So feel free to take a look at it, and if you have any questions, we can save those to the end.
If somebody is not eligible to be admitted but has psychiatric issues and they're hospitalized and they're alone with no support system, what preventative measures are to keep them in the hospital and from slipping through the cracks? That's a concern of mine.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a very good question, and I'm going to let Vina answer that because I know she's got a slide talking about the assessments that are conducted on the crisis side and the medical necessity that must be met. Because that's a very important and critical piece that, you know, the crisis stabilization program does not necessarily serve or hospitalize people who are diagnosed with a mental illness. The individual has to be experiencing a current crisis that meets certain criteria, and she's going to talk about
okay,
that.
Thank you.
As well as other planning when the patient is not being hospitalized, kind of the aftercare plan.
Okay.
And then to answer your question, I think even further, if they're needing medical attention or and are at the hospital, typically patients are placed on what's called a 1799. So they stay there to stabilize whatever medically is going on with them. They typically get psychiatric consultations there and then still end up being referred to us, but after they're medically stabilized.
Does someone stay with them to have some continuity of care?
Usually the social workers will work closely
Great.
With them, and then the person who does a psychiatric consultation will typically see them multiple times during their stay there if it's that complicated medically.
That's good to hear.
Do both facilities accept Medi-Cal and private insurance? And they'll both?
The PUP is payer blind, and CSP, we take absolutely anyone that walks in our door.
Maybe an important question or thing to answer there is, you know, the psychiatric, the inpatient, well, on the crisis stabilization side, most insurance companies don't really recognize that outpatient service as a billable service. However, that's irrelevant because we still provide the service. So, you know, we attempt to collect, they don't pay, but we still provide the service. On the inpatient side, we are able to bill insurance directly. However, we do not have any contract with any insurance company, so all of these have to be on a single case. So they're called single case agreements. So basically what happens on the CSP side, if you have Blue Shield, you go there, typically the clinicians will explain some of the potential impacts of hospitalizing on the psychiatric health facility, which are typically insurance-related, higher copays. So we inform the patient about that. We notify the insurance company to get the single case agreement for the inpatient hospitalization, and then we start the negotiation at that point, but it doesn't happen until the patient is admitted. So sometimes patients do prefer or opt to go to their in-network provider instead of risking having to pay more for a hospitalization if they stay here in Santa Cruz.
So if you're near capacity, are you giving preference to Medi-Cal, Santa Cruz Medi-Cal?
So that's the part that, you know, Bina mentioned, and this is a little bit complicated because, you know, on the CSPN, they have to make sure that they're determining, you know, eligibility for benefits or insurance for the patients. That is a mandate that we have by the county for everyone. On the inpatient side, we're payer source blind, meaning if we get a referral, we don't care who's paying for it, we're looking at the referral. There's no one on the inpatient side looking at the patient and determining who comes in based on who's going to pay the bill.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we move on?
You might have answered this already, but how long can one stay on the inpatient side in the hospital?
On the inpatient side?
Mm-hmm.
So Laura will cover that in just a little bit.
It might be a short answer. I mean, we've had people stay there up to 6 months in a year.
Up to 6 months.
I mean, not because they met criteria, but we've had people stay for a very long time there.
Next slide, please.
So this one, kind of goes back to the data that I wanted to share with you guys. So this goes back to now the frequency of patient visits. So what we have here, this brown right here, is the number of people who presented to the CSP in a 12-month period and the number of episodes that they had. So on the CSP, there were 1,000 patients who visited the CSP once. There were 244 patients who visited the facility at least twice during that 12-month period. And there were 132 patients who had more than two CSP presentations. This is basically the same information, but a little bit different.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with this smaller pie. So 9% of the patients that the CSP sees have a total of 556 admissions into the inpatient. So 9% of the patients that the CSP sees use up about 30% of the resources in terms of assessments. And then the other numbers follow the same, 244 patients. And let's just double that because they have two admissions.
So why is that happening?
Because they're sicker.
Yeah.
It's the 20-80 rule, no? The 20%...
What that says to me is there are not other services out in the community to support their recovery once they get out of the hospital. That's what it means to me.
Those with family are not coming back.
I would just say that I was at that frequent flyer group is largely homeless.
Yes.
And have multiple additional problems and risk factors and needs a special treatment team and intervention strategy, if we were going to bring that, and it's not going to just happen on the
outpatient. Absolutely, and it definitely does require a lot of those outpatient services. Important to note here is that, you know, we have, I don't have the exact number, but we have many patients with multiple CSP hospitalization or multiple CSP visits who never end up hospitalized. And that is that because of those other factors that aren't strictly mental health related or related to the diagnosis, just other factors that are contributing to them visiting the CSP, including homelessness. We have examples just all day long of people coming in saying, oh, are you guys a shelter? No, okay, well, I'm going to kill myself. And then we have to tease out because, of course, we want to take whatever precautions are necessary. So we end up admitting, sometimes trying to tease out the different issues that are going on in the person's life.
In my own experience, it seems that it's the lack of coordination of care that contributes to the people I know going in, getting assessed. Maybe they get their loved one gets out with a plan of action that can't be put into place because the people in charge of that plan, the professionals, didn't participate in creating it, and they can't offer those services. There's a number of reasons. The assessments themselves haven't always been of the best quality because again, the professionals haven't been, those who've been taking care of that person haven't been involved. It's just this disjointed plan that you go to the hospital and the psychiatrist at the end of so many days says, okay, now go home and take care of this plan. That's kind of pretty out there. And that's just my experience, and those that I know, I mean, there are some success stories too, thankfully. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
I agree. Mm-hmm.
That's how it is.
So the licensed mental health professionals, again, consists of the registered nurses, the psychiatric social workers, the licensed vocational nurses, and then the psychiatric nurse practitioners. So those are the licensed professionals, and then we have the other support staff, the floor staff, the mental health professionals. As far as the evaluation process goes and the assessment, every client, whether they're voluntary or involuntary, gets the same assessments, gets the same treatment. There's no real difference to us besides the fact that they may have came in by themselves. So we bring them in, we make sure that they're medically stable. That's the very first piece. So we want to make sure that medically they're appropriate for our facility, since we don't have that the capacity to provide some medical care. So we start with vital signs, make sure they don't have anything unsafe on them, and the first assessment is the nursing assessment. So typically that's conducted by the licensed vocational nurses, consists of just general information as far as, you know, where they came from, what brought them in, if they have allergies, medications that we should know about, did they bring any medications in with them. It has a systems review to see if they have any medical problems. We check their skin to make sure there's no wounds or anything that need more attention immediately. And from we also assess functionality, sleep and hygiene patterns, that it's more medically focused to make sure that they're stable enough to be there. The second assessment, and probably one of the most important, crisis assessment, so that's conducted by the psychiatric social workers and also by the registered nurses. So that's where they get into the details of if there is that medical necessity, if somebody is a danger to themselves, a danger to somebody else, or gravely disabled, and based on their current presentation. So this is when they're speaking with the client, what brought them in, do they have past mental health treatment history, whether it be inpatient treatment or just therapy, any sort of treatment history that they may have, what their current needs may be, any substance abuse. They also conduct a mini mental status exam. We talk about different support systems that they may have, or abilities, interests, and from there we start to formulate the plan of what they need, if it's further treatment, if maybe we need to wait and reassess them, if they're going to need outpatient treatment, or what it is. We also do three different risk assessments. So we do a suicide risk assessment, we do a homicide assault risk assessment, and we also do a grave disability risk assessment. So these are tools and assessments that we use for every single client, whether or not they came in for all three of those, we assess for all. So even if someone came in just for being suicidal, there have been cases where maybe they're suicidal because they have voices telling them to hurt their loved ones, and that's why they want to kill themselves. So we do assess for all different sections of why somebody may be there or any risks that they may have. The assessments now are not just what the patient is telling us. That's a really small part of it. Besides that, if it's a voluntary client, they're not telling us much, but we're observing that they're having a hard time, that they're responding to internal stimuli, that they're, you know, they're not doing well. We can see that their hygiene is poor. That's also part of our assessment. So what we observe, we always, always, always want collateral information, whether it's from, so for the county notes, we check the health information exchange for every single client, whether they're connected to the county or not. There's two different sections on that information exchange. One is specifically for behavioral health, where coordinators, providers will put different notes if they've had assessments, if they've been meeting with them, and you may be able to sometimes see a trend of them starting to decompensate. But there's also another section, which is from just like Dominican ER. They have their notes uploaded on there. and we've been able to find information on there related to mental health. Maybe they went to the ER and thought that they had mercury poisoning from a thermometer, so you may see some paranoia or other behavioral health symptoms, even if it's not under the behavioral health section or they're not connected to the county. So we check that on every single client that comes in just to see if there's any sort of collateral. We always ask for every client that comes in, we go through the consent package and try to obtain permission to speak with any family or friends. That happens at the front end and, again, throughout the entire assessments when the nurses talk with them, when the social workers speak with them. We try to obtain that throughout the whole visit. Most times we're able to get at least a number or two, but if we have the opportunity to gain collateral, we definitely do that. And then the self-report, so what the patient is reporting or what they're telling you.
What about people? Sorry. What about people calling in? I know I tried when my neighbor and tenant was brought in a couple weeks ago. I made 4 calls, and no one ever picked up the phone. I left messages with a lot of what I thought was very pertinent and important information about his behavior.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever called back.
Wow. Yeah, so, I mean, typically our standard, I've never called and not gotten an answer, so that should be very, very rare if...
This was over the New Year's weekend. I called 4 different days.
Wow. Typically we always have somebody in the office where the phones are. That's a rule. We at least have one person in there, and that's something that we follow. When we have somebody call in, and this is one of the areas that I wanted to speak on as well, we may not be able to confirm that somebody is there just due to HIPAA. So, you know, even if somebody tells you that, you know, unfortunately I can't confirm or deny, please still give information. We still take that into account. We still take down names and phone numbers. If this person happens to come here, we will have your name and number on file. If we can take collateral, you know, we had a situation the other day where we were able to successfully divert a client from jail by taking collateral before we ever knew who this person was or laid eyes on them, communicating to dispatch and to the emergency room that they may be seeing this client and we want them at our facility. And it just so happened they were going to be taken to jail again, but because of that contact and gathering that collateral, we were able to get them to our unit. So. Yes.
Everyone should know that there's a form available. It's an AB 1424 form for family members to write down history and give all the input you want. And you guys should hand them out to people and tell them to come by and pick one up. They tell them everything about your loved one. And they're required to read it and take it into consideration.
Where do you get the form?
They're on our website.
It's on the Christ page.
And also, if you've taken family to family, in your crisis red folder, in the front pocket, there is a copy of that.
Yeah, that's super helpful because if your loved one's in the crisis, most likely you're also kind of in a crisis yourself, and it's really hard to remember all the details about their treatment, you know, if there were medication changes or when that behavior started to change. So having a form like that would really, yeah.
What was the name of it, AB?
1424. It's called a family input. What's it called, Cheryl?
I can't recall.
It's something, or you remember?
But it's, I think it's, there's only 2 forms on the crisis page. One of them is an advanced directive.
Yeah, it's right near the advanced directive form.
How do you handle advanced directives in the crisis stabilization?
We haven't seen many. We have a couple maybe when there's really involved family members and, you know, the parents will contact us right away. So we keep those on file and let everybody know.
That might be something handy to fill out for there's a crisis.
To ask the question, like, why some mentally ill people who was arrested by law enforcement brought to jail and some to crisis center? How does it work? You know, how they evaluate who goes to jail, who goes to...
Yeah, so law enforcement, you know, they're trained to do evaluations to see if somebody fits criteria for a 5150. And again, the 5150, that's the 72-hour hold. It's an application for somebody to obtain a psychiatric evaluation. A lot of the time, if they don't know their history or if it, you know, if they just think that it's something related to substances or behavior, they may take them to jail. But jail also has professionals there that do assessments and see if somebody may need to be transferred to us to the psychiatric help unit.
And yes, my daughter was evaluated as a gravely disabled person at your place, but still district attorney filed charges against her. So, and she got no help. So who can help in that situation?
You know, I don't know that I would be able to, but I would definitely say that probably there's a public defender involved, and I think that's the person that would look at the case and the presenting circumstances. So I think I would work with the public defender.
Can help.
That's unfortunate.
Are you able, as part of your assessment, to do any kind of drug screens, any swabs, or any urine
sample? Yeah, we do a urine toxicology on everyone, and of course they have the right to refuse, but just like trying to obtain consent to speak with family members and friends, we ask the entire duration of their stay. So we do do the urine toxicology.
You know, we don't keep stats on this, because again, I mean, our focus isn't so much substance use, but I know that anecdotally, any of our clinicians will, you know, highlight just the prevalence of drugs in our community and, you know, pot in the water. The vast majority come in with at least, you know, positive on THC, and definitely large numbers of people high on weed. LSD, we don't have drug screens, or there aren't effective drug screens to identify that, and a host of other drugs that we can't identify.
Bath
salts don't register on our drug tests. But the prominent ones that we see are pretty typically THC, meth, cocaine,
opiates,
definitely.
We've seen PCP a couple times. Some
would
of
you
them.
Say majority, would you say 60% people have
a wild
feeling? Or 90%?
I would say it's probably closer to 70%.
I was going to say around 70% at least.
Did you say 70?
I would say about 70%.
At what point?
Just some sort of substance use involved with the crisis that they're going through. Yeah.
When a patient is discharged, the evaluation obviously says that they're in a stable enough position that one to be allowed to leave. Is it required that there are specific steps that they're supposed to take, or is it just like, you're well, I'll see you later, have a nice day?
No, I'll go over that next. So I wanted to do the assessment piece, and then I'm going to get into the discharge. But we do an aftercare plan with everyone. Any other questions on the assessment piece so far? Yes.
Did you say that the law enforcement is trained to deal with the whole law enforcement?
I mean, that's part of their job, is they do evaluations to see if somebody needs to be placed on a 72-hour hold.
And who trains them?
Just recently, in this last year, the county put on a huge training for law enforcement officers throughout the county. They did a training with our staff, with staff at Dominican, in an effort to really make sure that everyone has the same understanding of applying this 72-hour hold. I believe it was Marty Riggs, who's right now the person who oversees the Crisis Stabilization Program, El Dorado and Telos, who's been in charge of training on that 5150 hold.
There's been a big improvement in the last year on their training.
And separately, I know that there are officers that are also trained in crisis intervention, methods specifically to address people in a mental health crisis to improve outcomes.
Yeah, we've had some nice stories recently of sheriffs being extremely kind and patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've seen that more and more, and they always, they're able to, when we get officers that drop clients off, they'll ask questions and engage, and there's the education piece as far as, if they write a hold that maybe doesn't explain the whole story, like, okay, well, you put them on the hold and you're taking their, their rights away and bringing them to this locked unit, so what justifies this or what else happened, and trying to gain more collateral or just working with them to really strengthen what the what yeah. they look like.
We've also had some bad stories, but recently some good stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just, I don't want to be blanket, everything's great. Yeah, everybody right. still needs more training.
Definitely, always.
I mean, I know that Laura's going to talk about the discharge and the aftercare plan, which is going to resemble, I think, much of what you guys do on the CSP. So if you want to hold up on that, we'll jump to the psych side, unless there's something else in there.
Sorry,
just being conscious of time. I know it's already 8:05, and I think we have to 8:30, right?
Yeah.
So I want to make sure that we can see some of these other pieces.
Thank you,
Arnie.
Thank you.
Psych health facility, now the inpatient side.
Hi, I'm Laura, and I have been working at the PUP for about 6 months now, and I can't tell you, I've got about 16 years experience in the field, and I haven't worked with such a great group of people as I have at the PUP. I've worked with great doctors, great nurses, great floor staff, and so I really feel like I came on into a really well-oiled, kind of creative, and really well-trained facility. So I'm really lucky to have joined this team. So the psychiatric health facility is the inpatient side. And you can come in voluntarily, which we do have several people admitted voluntarily. You come in on a 5150, as we explained, which is a 72-hour hold, or people come in on a conservatorship. And we have about 500 hospitalizations annually. Our average length of stay is not 3 days. It tends to be 10 days, although 30% of it, the length of stay, is attributed to people waiting for locked care. So basically, we have people either conserved on our unit or they're placed on a temporary conservatorship, and then they just sit and wait. And statewide, there is no locked care beds. So 7th Avenue doesn't have openings, and all over the Bay Area doesn't have openings. And it's not just local to Santa Cruz. This is all over California. So,
Carol, you asked the question about Angwin. You know, why do people get sent out to Angwin? And you know, one of the answers is that, you know, in this county, we have one source for locked beds. That's 7th Avenue Center, and the county contracts for, I think, about 10 beds or case-by-case basis, but I think they have up to 10 patients at 7th Avenue.
Yeah.
They have probably a couple dozen more outside of this county.
Yeah.
There are other patients who are served outside of this county in locked beds. So pretty typically, when we have someone who is going to require what is called an IMD or a locked bed, we make referrals to multiple sources depending on the program, the appropriateness. But sometimes we have to kind of do a scattershot to make sure that they're on a lot of people's wait lists because of the long delays. So sometimes an Angwin bed comes up before 7th Avenue bed.
Yeah. And I can tell you, Angwin actually loves working with Santa Cruz County because they say Santa Cruz County comes and sees their client and gets them out quick. So
what,
they don't
what
just
is
leave
Ang,
them.
What does Angwin mean?
Angwin is a facility in Angwin, California. It's one of the, it's like 7th Avenue Center.
Where is that?
So it's by Calistoga. It's way out there. Pass a lot of beautiful wineries. It's in the middle of the mountain.
Laura's job before was to work specifically with people in locked care, so she was the state traveler, as Carol mentioned.
Yes. And it's very similar to 7th Avenue, but it's smaller. And like I said, they like working with Santa Cruz County because Santa Cruz County Mental Health doesn't leave them there just to languish like other counties do. So that's a real plus for Santa Cruz County that they pay a case manager to go out there and visit people knowing that they can't bill for that service. So I think that's great for them.
But they don't visit very much.
They only get to go up about once a month for this trip. It's not a lot. It's definitely not local.
That's a lot.
So recovery culture, we talked a little bit about restraints and seclusions, and I'm going to speak more to the 6 months that I've been there. I can give the grand total of seclusions are about 100 for the year. But for the last 6 months, the PUF side, we had the highest amount of seclusions in 1 month was 9. And then in the last 6 months, we've had 2 people in mechanical restraints.
Wow.
So we're really conscientious of being trauma-informed. And our staff is really good. Whether you're licensed or unlicensed, they're all trained in nonviolent crisis intervention. And our floor staff is superb at recognizing when someone's agitated and de-escalating them before they reach a point where they're escalating or out of control and need something to contain them. So personally, I find that really amazing because we know that coming into the PUP already is a traumatic experience. And when you take away someone's rights to go leave outside of a locked door, that's already a trauma.
Stats time.
Yeah.
Again, this is now the inpatient side. We're going to do the same thing in regards to admissions. Again, these are unduplicated patients. So we had 306 individuals who had one inpatient hospitalization during that 12-month time frame, 80% of the people that we serve. Around 56 patients had more than, or two admissions, and then 26 patients had more than two admissions.
56 had two?
Yes, 56 patients had two admissions during that 12-month time frame, and 26 patients had more than two. So here again, we see a similar thing, same 306 episodes for 306 people. The 26 individuals made up around 86 of the admissions, and 56 times 2 is 112. That wasn't a math problem. And this goes out to also take into account the number, the total days on the inpatient side, right? Let's talk about the 26 individuals. 26 individuals had a total of 86 hospitalizations for a total of 1,461 days on the inpatient. If you do an, if you take an average, that means that these 26 patients spent an average of 56 days in the hospital, comprising about 30% of our total patient days. And there you see that between these two groups, they comprise the majority of our of our patient days inside the hospital.
In the emergency room, they said that they had a way to deal with frequent flyers by giving them each a designated social worker to try to help them navigate and keep coming in appropriately for appointments and stuff, and that really reduced the numbers. Do you have a similar thing that you can appoint somebody as a social worker for these people, or is that beyond your bailiwick?
Yeah, you know, I'm not just saying this as a as an inpatient administrator, but I truly believe that what happens in the outpatient world is going to determine what whether or not someone is hospitalized. I'd love to take credit for something that we do that just keeps people out of the hospital altogether, but I know that there are impacts outside of our communities. Right now we're working with the county to identify these individuals to really do more targeted case management and to come up with some alternative planning to make sure that we reduce the number of hospitalizations, especially knowing that a lot of these individuals are conserved individuals who, when they come to our inpatient center, they take up a lot of days because they're waiting for some other place to open up. So they're not necessarily individuals that meet criteria for the entirety of their stay.
I have a question. So if someone goes there voluntarily, but if they didn't go there voluntarily, they would have been put on a hold. How does that assessment?
So if someone's on a voluntary status at the PUP, at any point, if they're meeting criteria, they can be put on a hold.
Well, I know, but, okay. My son went to, he's in crisis right now. He's in the crisis center right now. And if he did not voluntarily go with me, his mental health worker would have put him on a hold to go there. And she did go there with us. So My concern right now is because he went there voluntarily, I don't want him released, but I need, I guess, do you look at it differently if they go voluntarily versus when their mental health worker goes with them?
I think it helps sell it once you tell us in Alvarado when they're ready for discharge, so that we can say, hey, they're here accepting treatment.
Yeah.
They'll work your program. But no, like I said, they can come to our unit on a voluntary status, and then it can be, at any moment, they can be placed on a 5150. So if they're meeting criteria in the doc, so let's say that they say, hey, I want to leave.
Even on the crisis unit, we can initiate a 5150 at any time.
So if they say, hey, I want to leave, no matter what, before they leave, they're going to be assessed. And if they're assessed and people are thinking, hey, this person's not ready to go, they're going to be put on an involuntary hold, and it does happen.
Yeah, you know, I think the only mitigating factors in that is just time. Let's say welfare and institution code, it encourages or discourages you putting someone on an involuntary hold if they're willing to seek treatment. So if they want treatment, there's no reason to under this legal designation.
Yeah. My concern is that he did go there voluntarily.
Agreed. So then, the pressure that our clinical staff is under sometimes is definitely when the voluntary patient says, I'm done, let me out of here. In that moment, the clinicians have to make an assessment to determine whether or not this individual is now meeting criteria for an involuntary hold, because now they're not seeking services voluntarily. They don't want services, but I still have the responsibility of making sure that when this person walks out that door, they're going to be safe to themselves or to someone else. In cases where I feel or the clinicians feel like the person is not a danger to himself or herself, and they feel like the person can go, they still let them know that they're leaving against medical advice, because we would like to continue the assessments. So we have them sign out against medical advice, AMA. So we give them a form letting them know that it's not our recommendation that they be released. They're not meeting criteria for a hold, but we really would like them to stay to be assessed.
How can that impact their future ability to be served?
None at all. And, that's one of the, I think that really is one of the things that we want to make the crisis service itself. I mean, we want it to be a place where people who feel like they're not feeling safe to come in, voluntarily seek services, and then go home after they feel better.
Okay.
We want the service to be accessed that way. We think it's an important part of community mental health. Ron?
I have a question about the relationship with Telos and El Dorado. It sounds like they're being very picky about who they take around the discharges, and it used to be that there was tremendous flow between the inpatient unit and the two facilities, and there was waiting lists often about step downs, but that they were very desired extensions, if you will, particularly medication stabilization and rehab and usually preparation for housing or an attempt to get people into housing. And has criteria changed for those two programs? What's changed?
I think resource has changed. There's not enough housing. We're in a logjam right now. We have people staying at El Dorado for a longer period of time. So there isn't that many openings. There's only 16 beds there. And I'm hearing that people are staying there for about 3 months now on average. So there aren't a lot of openings for El Dorado. I can only speak on our end that we send them every day a list of who's ready. So it's up to them, if they have a bed to come assess. We are working with the county to ensure that housing council and otherwise that our level of care is considered the highest priority. So if we ever hear that there's a wait list, I say no, there's no wait list, because we jump the line. So I can't speak for what their criteria is or whether that's changed, but I do know that we actively communicate, and I know that there isn't enough step-down resources right now, and then there's a lot more homelessness. There's not El Dorado and Talos are stuck with the and then what for a lot of people who don't want to go back to homelessness, but it's not a housing fix. So that's a bigger question for Encompass and the county, I think.
I think the one, yeah, definitely there are bottlenecks. I mean, I know that the residential facilities, the Borden Cares, we see very few patients coming into the inpatient unit. I think I've probably only seen like, you know, two or three Front Street patients during the time that I've been there, very few, which is great because people are living stably in their homes, but that means that those are pretty tapped out. There's no more housing being built to alleviate, let's say, from El Dorado. So there's definitely a bottleneck issue. I think another issue that's contributing to who gets placed where is comorbidity issues. People who are incontinent, people who are diabetic, people who have seizures, people who have a difficult time ambulating, which again are very commonplace issues for the population that we serve, especially the people who visit us often. So those are the types of issues that get highlighted to us with facilities that haven't really adapted yet to meet comorbidity issues.
So you're having backup for people who are waiting for skilled nursing beds?
Oh, yeah.
which is impossible from our setting.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a lot of stigma with skilled nursing if they're coming from a locked psych unit.
Yeah.
We have much more success if they're at Dominican to get them to skilled nursing. So we're working. I've heard through the grapevine that Central Coast Alliance is willing to work with us and sort of help foster. And we haven't actually had a referral directly to skilled nursing since I learned of this service. So, but apparently Central Coast Alliance is going to work with us.
Great.
So it's exciting. You have a question?
I'm hoping you're going to go into the services that the hospitalization provides.
That's the next slide.
So in the very first 24 hours, when someone walks in from the CSP to the PUP, they're going to see all these people. So all these people conduct assessments within 24 hours of the person coming from CSP into inpatient. So nursing does the risk assessment, which is great because they get the second time around the risk assessment. So suicide risk, assault risk, substance abuse, et cetera, that I know Vina talked about. The bummer part is that they have to answer all these questions again, and it's usually the fourth time that they're answering it, but it's pretty thorough. We do have a nurse practitioner that comes in and does an HMP. Additionally, with the nursing, they immediately start treatment planning, and they're not just treatment planning psych, they're also treatment planning whatever medical treatments they're getting. Our psych nurses, I've seen them save lives. They do a really great job, and it's not just giving pills to people. It's actually healing and catching medical events and seeing a change of a condition that for someone that can't communicate or is too disorganized, they do save lives. It's great. We have a psychiatrist that sees them within 24 hours and conducts an evaluation. We won't release someone from inpatient until the psychiatrist evaluates them. So even if they're on a 72-hour evaluation and they're meeting criteria, no matter what, the psychiatrist has to evaluate too. We have social services, which are mostly licensed and associate social workers that collect collateral from family members if they could get released some information or at least listen to information. They're engaging with case coordination. They have a county case manager. They're finding out who their PCP is, ideally making an appointment because they're so far out. And we have rehab services that are assessing their functionality. And they also are pretty much the crux of how we tailor our treatment plan to their individual interests. So their whole job is finding out what makes them feel whole as a person, and they're going to figure out what they like to do and integrate everything that they like to do to make their experience feel valuable. So we have these legal proceedings, and I know we talked about the 5150 And the only way you can put someone on a three-day hold is if they're meeting criteria for danger to others, danger to self, or grave disability, or a mixture of the three. And I did give a handout, I don't know if you guys grabbed it, of all the different legal proceedings and holds for mental health. And it does show whether you have to be on a danger to others or danger to self or grave disability to be in that legal hold. So it just clarifies things. These are the most general ones that we use. So the 52, oh, I'm sorry.
What's the criteria for grave disability?
Grave disability means that you cannot provide food, clothing, or shelter due to mental health symptoms. So you have to, your mental health symptoms have to interfere with your ability to provide for your basic needs. So after 3 days, the doctor can initiate a 5250, and that's an additional 14-day hold. And it could be for any of the three, grave disability, danger to self, danger to others, or a combination. They initiate a 14-day hold. And there is a certification hearing. So the psychiatrist and we as a facility have the burden of proof. So our observations, our notes, our interactions have to prove that this person is meeting criteria in medical necessity. They are going to have a patient's right advocate and the hearing officer that comes to our facility and listens to each case. So if the 5250 is upheld, you get an additional 14 days to the three-day hold. So it can be a total of 17 days. If that person needs more time, generally the only people that are going to need more time are going to meet criteria for grave disability. And that way we can put them on a 5270. We initiate a certification for that. You can only do it for grave disability, and they do have a certification hearing for that as well. And again, the burden of proof is on us and what we're seeing, what the psychiatrist is seeing 24 hours a day. The 5270 is for 30 days, and usually if someone's put on a 5270, it means that we're looking at, do they meet criteria for conservatorship? Not something we take lightly. We know at this point, I know from the 6 months I've been at the inpatient, that oftentimes people wait for lock care and on conservatorships and actually resolve their mental health needs in our inpatient unit before they even get a bed. So it's definitely something that we know it's a big legal impact on the client. And it's usually our last resort to conservatorship initiation. The conservatorship starts as a TCON, temporary conservatorship, that's 30 days, and then they have a court proceeding that's not on the acute unit, it's at the courthouse. They get a public defender, and again, the burden of proof is on everyone but the client. The client just has to be able to present a reasonable plan for food, clothing, and shelter, and demonstrate that their mental health symptoms are not interfering with their ability to implement this reasonable plan. They can go into a permanent conservatorship, and a permanent conservatorship is up to a year. So if it's longer than a year, that means that two doctors have to reinitiate it. A capacity Reese hearing, you can only have a Reese on someone who's on an involuntary hold. And essentially, if you're on an involuntary hold, you still have the right to refuse medications. And if the psychiatrist feels like, no, you need these medications, you're on an involuntary hold, they will initiate a Reese hearing. Again, the burden of proof is on us. It's on the psychiatrist. This hearing happens at our facility. The psychiatrist testifies with the client and the hearing officer and the patient's right advocate. And then the writ of habeas corpus, filing a writ means that you are protesting your locked detention. This happens at the county courthouse. You can initiate it on the 5250. You can do it on the 5150, but usually people wait. I think you can do it on the 51. I think it's just the 5250. And they can do it at any point. And that has to go in front of a judge down on Ocean Street. And again, like I said, we need to demonstrate that someone needs to be under lock and key with supervision. We have to have documentation of medical necessity. Any questions?
Thanks. Just an observation. I do these support groups, and I hear again and again and again family members who have relatives that are homeless and in just really dire condition, and apparently they're not considered gravely disabled because they're released.
Yeah. I don't know the specific person that you're talking about.
Well, there's more than any specific person.
But you can be homeless, and it doesn't mean you're gravely disabled. It has to be as a result of your mental health symptoms. So I don't know the specific
case.
And
to family members, it's obvious that it's their mental health symptoms.
Yeah, but we can all agree that someone needs to be held, but the hearing officer may have a different opinion. And that has happened.
I think one of the biggest things to really, that's been a challenge to kind of tease out, describing medical necessity without implying that the individual does not need mental health treatment. So absolutely, we do see people that are psychotic, they're speaking to themselves, they have these wild delusions, and they can also articulate how they're going to get food. They know how to navigate the shelter system, and they're very psychotic. They very clearly, to any of us, would be someone that would say, wow, that person needs medication to help them stabilize, but that doesn't mean that that is medical necessity to take them off the street and put them in a treatment facility. And I think that's really one of the challenges that we have, is trying to distinguish between needing the service, but meeting medical necessity to just pick you up and put you in a locked facility against your will.
So I raised the question about, what is it called, like assisted outpatient care? Is that other counties have passed county by county regulations on that? I think there's big movements back east because she mentioned the HR 2646 that's encouraging that. How would that impact this, where it's a court ordered, you must take your medication?
Yeah, James, we've got someone from Santa Cruz County trying to hide in the corner back there. It's James Russell. You want to introduce yourself, James? I'm putting you on the spot.
Not being prepared to speak to this, but coming more from a law enforcement background myself, and say that the law errs on the side of the person it's subject to. So the burden of proof is on the clinicians and the caretakers. And the law, and forgive me for how I'm going to frame this here, but isn't worried about what's in the best interest of the person, which obviously family and caregivers are. The law is worried about, does this person meet the requirements of the law? And so if that person in that instance meets that criteria for hospitalization, for LPS conservatorship, whatever, in that moment, even knowing that 2 days down the road from now when they stop taking their medications, they'll be back where they were when they started, because in that moment, the law says, no, we have to drop this proceeding. We do something similar to the... forget what that law is.
Laura's law.
Yeah. With our mental health court and with special conditions of probation, take medications as prescribed. Because again, you're still going to have to go through this. Even those laws do not supersede the 5150 and LPS Act. Nothing will supersede those. Those are the baseline laws. So again, it kind of requires a little bit of buy-in, because even our mental health conditions here locally for someone who's been convicted of a crime, it says, you're going to take medications as prescribed. You're going to comply with mental health directives from the county. However, the person has to agree to that. So it's kind of like on the other end of the stick, there's this, or you'll go to jail for this long, or you can do this and be out in the community and working on your personal goals and stuff and working with you. So it's a catch-22, and it just takes a lot of really, you know, if somebody doesn't want to get better, they're not going to, you know. And so you've got to really motivate people to buy into getting better. Yeah. So it takes a lot more energy on all of our part to get there. I'm sorry if I didn't really answer your question too long.
But that goes back to what somebody said. Too bad your son was arrested.
Yeah.
And again, my position, just to articulate that a little bit more, my position is I work as a liaison with the sheriff's office. And so we've embedded a liaison now for mental health with each of the three major law enforcement agencies, Watsonville, Santa Cruz PD, and the sheriff's office. So we're trying to address a lot of these issues so that we can divert people not going to jail and get them to the treatment and, again, you know, for the long-term haul, getting people motivated for their own treatment.
Yeah, I'd like to take a minute to say thank you to James for his right on work with us. And then I'd also like to add about Laura's Law and assisted outpatient treatment. If you have court order treatment, it's just been shown to be tremendously successful. And now about 5 or 6 of our counties in California have adopted it. And it is, like they call it, the black robe effect, that just having a court, a judge be involved in where a person is coming in to have a conversation and check how are you doing with your treatment team. It's been shown to be very effective. It's court order assisted outpatient treatment that doesn't require that you commit a crime to get that kind of care. And I'm in favor of it, personally.
Can I ask, do you know if the new proposed law in Congress will increase assisted living support money?
It will give more money, yes, I know that. And there's a big chunk of money for research that I'm happy about. Yeah,
great.
So, last, and we'll try and make this quick because I know we're running over. We do a huge part of our jobs, everyone's job on the PUF is discharge planning, and we try and initiate that from the moment that people get there because we know that there's a lot of obstacles that we have to cross with any particular patient to get them out the doors, whether it's they don't want to be homeless anymore, they need county coordination, they need a psychiatrist, they need a therapist. There's a lot of things that we're trying to suss out. But there are 3 types of discharges, and I know Jorge touched on AMA. Essentially, let's give an example that someone had a certification hearing for 5250, and they win. We're going to ask them to sign in voluntarily. They may choose not to. And if they do, we're going to tell them you're going to be signing against medical advice and what the consequences is, which is really like an unplanned discharge, which is, in my feelings about it, is that the best outcome for someone is going to be a thoughtful, planned discharge where everything's connected for them and we're trying to find the pathways from our unit to their next steps. We do have medical discharges. That's people leaving via ambulance to the hospital. Again, I referenced our nurses. That's when they're assessing our clients and finding out that they could be their medical needs are superseding their psychiatric needs and they're in emergency situations. But mostly we have routine discharges, and we do talk every day about every single client in an interdisciplinary team. And we're always talking about medical necessity, and we're always talking about the best interests of the client and what a good discharge is going to look like and what's the appropriate level of care. And I only speak for myself and not them, but I come from the philosophy that anyone can be discharged at any time depending on where they're going. So if we have the most plush resources available, discharge planning could probably happen a lot quicker for a lot of our clients. However, we don't have that, so people do stay for 10 days while we're trying to figure it out. We do make a lot of referrals. We provide referrals to the PCP. As you probably know, in Santa Cruz County, we're a little short on psychiatrists. So unfortunately, our PCPs are taking the burden of a lot of prescribing of medications. We do have people or patients that have outpatient psychiatrists, and we'll make appointments for them. We do have people that are not system of care, meaning that they don't have a county psychiatrist or they don't have a county coordinator. In those instances, we're using their PCP, but we're also trying to find creative, sort of out-of-the-box ways of getting resources for people. We've done referrals for like hospice drop-in groups for people experiencing loss, like anything we can find that's affordable for someone in out there. We also are doing direct referrals or indirect referrals to substance use, depending on which program, but we're initiating it from our facility, particularly if their psychiatric symptoms have stabilized and now they're ready to go to rehab. As you know, we have the crisis residential program and the subacute one, El Dorado. And if someone's requiring any kind of case management or county doctor, we do start the access alert process upon admission. Any questions?
What's the access alert process?
The access alert process happens in our treatment meeting in the morning. And if we see someone that either is coming in more than once and pretty severe symptoms, or if we're seeing someone that just definitely could benefit from a coordinator, we're going to say, hey, this person needs an access alert. And then someone from the access team at the county actually comes to our facility and meets with the client. The only barrier that we've seen to this is that sometimes the patient doesn't want to talk to the person interviewing them. And that seems to be the one thing that's starting to block getting services for them or a coordinator, is that they're not ready to meet at that time. So we're kind of doing a dance of when are they ready to be interviewed so that we can get them services.
So the last slide is just open for questions. It concludes the presentation. In other words, our time